You're listening
to the CD Baby.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
DIY. DIY.
Oh. Musician.
Musician. Podcast.
Hey there, and welcome to episode number 263 of the DIY Musician Podcast. My name is Kevin Bruner, and joining me is Chris Robley. And on today's episode, we'll be discussing how to deal with failure and rejection. Chris, neither of us have ever had to deal with that, have we?
No. In fact, I was saying our lives have been just one string of easy victory to the next.
That's right.
We're blessed. Hashtag.
That's what being a musician is like. It's just all easy going.
We're sick of winning, as someone has promised. No, I'm actually really excited to talk about this subject because people who listened maybe to one of our last couple episodes might know that I got a bunch of rejection from my latest single, which sort of prompted this discussion. So I'm happy to be transparent and wounded for on behalf of all of us.
Yeah, it's one of those things whenever you have any sort of artistic pursuit where you're putting yourself out there and it feels like you're being very vulnerable and people have plenty of opinions and they'll give you feedback that maybe you didn't want, maybe you did want, maybe you don't like. We're going to be discussing that today. And so our big question, so we put out a big question before, and that was about what are your plans for the fall of 2020? We're still happy to get that. If you want to call in or email that. But our new big question is, how have you dealt with rejection or failure with your music career? Is there a particular event that comes to mind that really hurt? Or was there some way that you turned it into a victory? You know, sometimes you can turn these things around or put it to good use. Our listener line is 360-524-2209, or you can email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com. And before we get into that discussion, I should also say that we have lots of great calls later in the show and some emails that you're going to want to stick around for. But first, there was a bit of news that I think's worth sharing, Chris, in that, you know, Amazon had purchased Twitch, and now they are the first digital music provider to combine live streaming into the digital music streaming platform.
It's true. Amazon's coming for everyone. I feel like they're poised to be the major streaming service in the US fairly soon.
As I have said many times on this podcast that, you know, for a long time, people have said it's an Apple Music and Spotify game. And then, you know, we've been working very closely with the folks at Amazon Music. And as you remember, CD Baby was the first independent provider. I think it was the first provider in general to allow artists to connect to Amazon Music for Artists, where there's a lot of interesting data like Alexa data and how many people are accessing your music through talking to a device. That's very interesting. But in that process, I'm like, you know what? They're really making some moves. And Amazon's got all those credit card accounts just like Apple does, if not more, because everyone's ordering off Amazon more than ever now. And so if they, you know, up their game on the product side, which they're doing, they could really end up being the number one service pretty quickly.
Yeah, and by the time this episode airs, there should be an article up on the DIY Musician blog that'll have more information about the integration between Twitch and Amazon Music and kind of how to set it up within Amazon Music for Artists. I can't give you the cliff notes right now because I actually haven't done it yet, but we'll have the info soon.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, you know, when we started talking about all the live streaming stuff when the pandemic started, I think we even mentioned that, you know, no DSP had allowed live streaming yet, but it's here.
It's pretty huge. Yeah. And then speaking of DSPs, I also think that by the time this episode airs, we can announce that we are partnering with Rezo. So CD Baby will be sending your music to Rezo, which, if anyone doesn't know what that is, it's basically TikTok's music streaming app. It's launched by the same company that owns TikTok, and It's pretty cool from what I can tell. It's not in the US yet, but it's in Brazil, Indonesia, and India. And there's all kinds of like community, social media type things within the streaming app. And so what was Apple's attempt at that like a decade ago?
Ping was, yeah, that was the one that I think that's what it was called. That was the one that was supposed to be like a social network.
Yeah, I mean, it seemed sort of dead on arrival, so it immediately went out of my mind. But but this, unlike that, from what I can tell, really looks like, you know, something where the social media interactive component of communities talking to each other around, you know, favorite songs or favorite artists actually seems like it could take off. We'll see. But anyways, CD Baby is sending your music there.
Yeah, we did a workshop, a 3-day sort of virtual conference in Brazil last week. And I was watching. I didn't understand a word of it, but I have Brazilians on my team that's why they're there. They know those things. But I was watching, and this service, I opened it up, and there was someone giving a presentation, and it was this interesting looking service. I was like, hey, I have no idea who is this? What are they talking about? And they were like, oh, it's Rezo. I'm like, oh yeah, that looks really cool. And yeah, so it is available in other territories and gaining popularity. And, you know, things like that also to me highlight, man, is Apple just missing the boat in a lot of these things? I mean, you know, you mentioned that they've tried twice to do some sort of like social interaction, but they want it to be so controlled to preserve the experience, which I understand. I understand that you want to preserve a user experience on your platform and make it clean and not deal with all the garbage that comes along with social networks and stuff like that. But it was so controlled that it didn't feel very social. And it seems like they've got the people and the money to make changes quicker. But so I'm just kind of curious what their plans are. But anyway, Amazon bringing live streaming to your digital service platform. And Rezo, a new addition to where your music will be all over the world. And that's going to be gaining a lot of traction, especially, you know, it's coming to the US, but it's already gaining traction in other territories because it is a global experience. Music is global and you need to be thinking global.
Yeah. And you know, this is a CD Baby podcast, so I'll do a 10-second CD Baby plug. When we have these new partnerships, you know, as long as it fits within the criteria you've set for your own music's distribution, like if you want to be available on streaming platforms, we're going to send your music to all these places free of charge. We're not nickel and diming you. There's no additional costs. We want to send you everywhere and just make sure you're set up and, you know, don't have to do a whole lot of maintenance. So that's why you use CD Baby. I assume if you're listening to this podcast, you use CD Baby.
We get a lot of outsiders, but that's okay. It's all right.
Well, now they should
switch. Everyone's welcome. And, you know, eventually they'll come around. In episode 262, we got a lot of good feedback about the advertisement platform that we have and just running ads in general. We talked a lot about. I wanted to throw out the coupon code again. If you want to try the ad builder platform in show.co, you can get $10 free towards an ad by using podcast10. So we got a good response on that coupon code. So it's still valid, I think, through the end of September. So give it a try. Podcast10. You know, just go to your CD Baby dashboard, click on the free marketing tools if you haven't already connected to show.co. And the ad builder platform is inside there. And the interactive ads are what we just launched and why we're offering this coupon, because it turns any Spotify link or YouTube video into an interactive ad. You don't even have to do anything. You just drop in the link, put in the you know, your call to action, and away you go.
Yeah, one thing I was going to say about that is after we recorded that episode, I heard from some musicians who, you know, really haven't done much or any advertising at all. So some of the, you know, basic terminology that we might take for granted kind of flew past. So for anyone that feels very green for advertising, I wrote an article that's also on the DIY Musician blog called, A Musician's Guide to Online Advertising or something like that. It's one of our newest articles. So check that out and we'll, you know, you'll get the definition of engagement and conversion and impressions and ROI and all these sort of ad terms that we might have used in that episode that could use some further explanation.
Yeah, there's a lot of buzzwords that marketers like to drop that you may not be familiar with. All right, let's get into the topic at hand and how to deal with failure and rejection. So, Chris, I know this was your idea for the episode. You want to lead us off, bring us into the discussion, and I'll get my notepad and take notes so I can give you a diagnosis at the end.
It came about because Jason from SubmitHub is a sort of automated pitching tool where you can pay a little bit of money per submission and you're guaranteed to reach the blogger or playlister with your music. And so anyways, they approached me about doing a kind of video interview and exploration of their platform, which I was happy to do, despite the fact that I'm going to reveal all of my rejections or at least that I got all rejections from the process. I still think it's a good service that delivers the only thing they guarantee, which is reach to these people. Anyways, we went through that process with him. He gave me some credits. I had a new single coming out. So I was like, all right, well, I'll pitch my new single to mostly blogs, but also some playlists. And I didn't quite know if I'd have any extra in because he was leading me through it. I didn't assume so. But once I was flatly rejected across the board, I was like, okay, he's not like pulling any strings or favors on my behalf, which, you know, good for them. Anyways, I read lots and lots of bloggers and playlisters telling me things they liked and things they didn't like about my music or about my song. And sometimes they agreed, sometimes they didn't. But ultimately, every single one of them told me no. I was bummed, but I thought this is a good opportunity to start talking about this because I am as guilty as any musician of really only putting out the good press and only, you know, having like a front as if like, oh, everyone loves me. Here's my good press from the LA Times and no depression. You know, I sort of like lean on good quotes I've garnered to like make people think I'm legit and they should take me seriously. Like, yeah, this isn't really healthy. We should have a discussion about failure and not being liked because I think it's certainly the norm across the board in the music industry, even for megastars. I mean, they're getting rejections as well. So anyways, that was the inspiration for why I wanted to talk about this topic.
Yeah, it's something every artist deals with. And, you know, depending on where you're at in your career, I think no matter where you are in your career, there's always, it feels like sometimes you get blindsided by it. Because sometimes you think, oh, these big established artists that have hits, they don't have to deal with rejection. I think sometimes it's worse for them. Just, you know, people start getting terrible.
Even this morning, I read an Atlantic article about Katy Perry's new album, which is coming out 10 years after her huge Teenage Dream album. And it's pretty critical. And it talks about the rejection she faced in 2017 when she put out this album that kind of flopped. And like, so someone even at her level, she's performed at the Super Bowl, you know, really contends with this stuff emotionally and then financially too, to spend a ton of money to release an album that doesn't do what you want it to, you know, it hurts. And then I'm sure just some snarky writer saying crap about your music also hurts, let alone, you know, the money and reputation you're losing.
Yeah. Well, you've got a lot of points here. How do you want to go down this list? You just want to go down them and discuss. Okay.
I think the first question I wanted to ask, and I have a theory, but is just why don't we like to admit rejection? And my theory is maybe this is goes across the board to any endeavor, but particularly in music or art, there's this way in which the art is simultaneously somewhat contradictory, like one of the deepest parts of yourself, but also very surface level. Like you're very exposed. And so it's easy to attack, and that attack goes right to the heart of you. So like, it's just, we're in a vulnerable position as musicians. We know that. And it hurts extra, you know, like if I don't do a good job at something I'm half invested in, oh well, I can blow that off. But when it's something I've devoted my life and my talents and all this stuff to, it really hurts. So that's, anyways, that's my theory, as well as the fact that, like, you kind of, you want to reach an audience, you want to grow your career, you want to make money, and all of that sort of rests on this idea that you're cool and that other people like you. And so you want to, like, you're ashamed of it when when that's not true. And so you want to hide that and, like, stuff it under the bed. But and at the same time, like, only put out there all the things that reflect back on you in a positive way, which is like what I was saying about press quotes or something. It's like, anyway, so that's my theory.
Well, why don't we like to admit rejection? Well, one thing I think about with music and art in general, it's all subjective. So to a point, you know, there's just bad music that nobody will like. But there's a lot of music that I would say I don't like that's, you know, a hit around the world, you know. So there's some subjectivity to it. And I think part of it is that we feel like we just need to convince people that it's good. And then, you know, you just, it's like that first follower thing. You get that first follower and then it's like, you know, remember that video of that dude dancing at that festival?
Oh yeah, totally. At Sasquatch Fest. Yeah.
Yeah. And then when that second follower comes, then everyone starts going. It's like, that's what it feels like with music, that you don't like to admit rejection because it feels like, well, they just don't know how good it is yet. And in some extent, that could be true.
I was going to say, I think there is truth in that. It's why, you know, for decades, major labels knew if they just dumped money into radio promotion, even songs you probably hated the first three times you hear them, eventually it's like Thin Lizzy's on the radio all the time now. Not to draw the ire of all the Thin Lizzy fans out there. But, you know, you hear something enough, suddenly it's like, oh, this is a classic. So there is a way you can kind of fool people beyond their initial responses or assumptions about the music. And yeah, I guess that's part of it too. But then the second thing I was curious about is, and I'm wondering if this is a shared experience, but, you know, we're always told, like, oh, don't read your own press, you know, like famous people who, like, are written about all the time are like, oh, I don't read press about me. And to some degree, that might be true for people who are literally being covered all around the world in every publication. But, like, come on, I know Katy Perry read that Atlantic article this morning, like, and I can't help but read it and invest in the experience of reading it. I remember, like, 10 years ago when I lived in Oregon and there was this Willamette Weekly or Willamette Week and what's the other one? Portland Mercury were like the two big weeklies. And anytime I had a show, I would, like, go out to the street corner and get the print version of that publication and scan through it to see if they wrote about my show. And, like, A, that's a big investment for me to, like, wake up and go get the thing. And then two, I read it. And if it was good, it made my day. I thought, oh, the rest of my life is going to be easy. The Willamette Week loves me. There's actually going to be, like, a few people at my show that wouldn't have been there otherwise. Yay. And if it was bad, it ruined me. And I was embarrassed to go in public and, like, because public for me was usually places where musicians hang out, and I knew they were all reading this stuff too. And anyways, so despite the fact that people say, oh, I don't pay attention to press. Yes, you do. I know you do. You're lying.
The Portland Mercury, when reviewing my band, Hello Morning, the band that I had here in Portland for a while, our album, they said that it sounded too professional and our guitars were too tuned.
Yeah.
And I was like,
very Portland.
That is the quintessential Portland experience. And if you were in Portland at the time, it was all, if you didn't have at least three guys in your band with a beard and at least one banjo, you weren't going to get a gig. So it was, for them to say that about it, it would just, it felt like an episode of Portlandia.
Yeah, that's perfect.
Yes. That one, you know, and that, I think, you know, there's all sorts of different types of rejection. And I think some of it you can use to harness for good, and others it's just confusing. And like that one I felt was confusing. And press, I think now, is something that I started taking with more of a grain of salt, because a lot of the big media outlets don't have the money and power that they used to, which were gatekeepers, but they also hired probably more established journalists. Uh-huh. And now all these online sites, a lot of times you get people writing about your music that really aren't art critics, or, you know, for example, like if Bob Boylan on from NPR gave me feedback about a song, I know Bob, I know how much he sits and listens and really it wants to be moved by the art and soaks it in. And he, you know, you and I talked to him about, you know, how much he listens and how he listens. And that's not what the average experience is for these people that are writing online, I think, that have I've had write about small town poets. And I'm like, I get upset, but then it's just like, this is just sloppy journalism. And now I'm just really upset because it's sloppy journalism.
Well, and like you say, it could be the same person that's supposed to cover like the local restaurant scene and films and like the city council meeting and whatever else. You're like, okay, I could take this with a grain of salt. But at the same time, I do have another theory, which I didn't mean to bring up in this, but I actually think sometimes the less critical ear, or sort of the less trained ear, can almost give better or more directly like emotionally honest feedback. And what I mean by that is, like, my wife knows nothing about music theory. She can, you know, barely identify a particular instrument and you know, say, oh, that's a bagpipe or that's an accordion or whatever in a recording. She really can't even decipher lyrics that well, but she has great taste in music. And when she makes playlists on Spotify, I go and I listen. I'm like, whoa, this is really cool stuff. Like, I'm always blown away by her taste, one. And despite her not knowing any of the music terminology or anything, when she's critical of my music, it's always helpful. Like, she's very quick to point out something in a more emotional context. But all that to say, don't necessarily discount someone's opinion just because they're not like a professional 20-year music critic or a musician themselves.
No, I agree with that. And what I'm referring to is more along the lines of sloppy journalism, where they feel like they're not allowed to say they like this record. And so now they got to pile on all this reasons why they dislike it at the end. You know, like, I could pull up some reviews where to explain, you know, to show what I'm talking about, where it just felt like, you don't know what you're talking about. You're trying to sound smart and you just sound like you don't. That's different than what you're talking about, where someone who is just giving honest feedback as a listener and not a music critic.
Yeah.
Well, that kind of leads us into your third point, that your music is not for everyone. It's a numbers game, and it's about finding the right fans.
Yeah, we say this a lot, but I mean, think about giant artists that you, the listener, don't like. I mean, I am indifferent to most of the music I hear. I actively hate some of the music I hear. and I love
You're
very
protesting.
Little of it. and so it's the same for everyone. Your music is not going to be for most people. So yeah, it's just about doing the things you need to do to find the people who do respond to it and fall in love with it. And I've used this example quite a bit lately as well, but like the Taylor Swift thing of when she's playing to 20,000 people or 50,000 people in an arena, there's hundreds of thousands or even millions of people that stayed home, and she's not counting those people. She sees a packed stadium, and that's her success. And I think, like, to jump to the fourth point I had, is that failure isn't necessarily the opposite of success. I think it's really the foundation of success. For whatever that's worth, maybe that helps us guard ourselves against investing too much in negative criticism or rejection. But yeah, count your victories instead of stewing on all of the failures.
Well, you bring up that Taylor Swift example, and what makes me laugh is, you know, being in a city like Atlanta, where the metro area, I don't know, it's like Atlanta's one of the largest cities in America now. When you count the whole metro area, millions and millions of people, and I'm standing on a stage in a club that capacity is 200, and there's 20 people there thinking, wow, there's a millions and millions of people here and I couldn't even get 200 of them.
Hey, but you know what? There's room for growth there. You had 180
That's right.
Capacity it's just possibility for next time.
It's just all upside. The one thing you said about your music is not for everyone, there was this review site that popped up, and I think they've gone under. I haven't seen, this was a couple years ago, and they wanted CD Baby to try it out. And so I tried it out, and all it was, you know, you upload a track and all these people would review it. And they were positioning it as, hey, upload your demos and have, you know, then you can create a song that gets feedback along the way from fans, which, newsflash, that's a terrible idea. But anyway, when you uploaded a track, so I uploaded a couple and to try it out. And one of them was a song of ours. I can't remember which one. I think to test it, I used one of our songs that was one of our big hits to just prove a point how useless this was. And the website erroneously was grading like you grade a paper at school. An A is 90 to 100%. A B was, you know, 80 to 90%. And this is of random people listening to music. It was not necessarily super genre focused. Like it might've had some high level genre, but still it was all random people. And so everything, including one of our big hit songs, was rated an F. Because I think the most I got was 45% on one of them, because I tried a couple songs and I was like, this website, the whole premise is wrong, because they're saying that a good song should be liked by 100% of random people, when that's just not the case. 30% of random people saying they like my song is a huge victory to me. Because
it's so bizarre to me that they didn't just know that, since that's the entire thrust of their service.
Yeah. And I gave them a bunch of feedback saying that I would never use this. I would never recommend it to an artist. The whole premise is flawed. I don't think they exist anymore. I haven't heard from them. They never responded to my email, and I've never heard from about them since. I can't even remember their name. But also the idea that getting feedback from fans on like song demos to help your writing, that's just not the kind of feedback you should be looking for in most cases, just because fans don't understand the creation process, and trying to get feedback from that was just a bad idea. So anyway, you also have to, you know, put things in perspective that not everyone's going to like your music. If you're a rock band and someone only likes hip hop, they're probably not going to like your music.
Right.
And that's okay. Go find the people that like rock and roll. All right.
Yeah, that is a good segue, I think, to the next thing I wanted to talk about is kind of just to list a bunch of kinds of rejection and failure. And what you're talking about is the first form of rejection that I wanted to mention, which is that most rejection is going to go unheard by you. And it's basically when people ignore you. They hear your song on a playlist and they skip it. Or they see that you got some blog feature and they just scroll by you. Or they, you know, whatever, see a video ad you're running on Facebook and they scroll by it. That's the type of rejection that maybe it's like the people who stayed home instead of going to the Taylor Swift concert. But it's going to be the bulk of people and you're never going to know about it. So that was the first thing I wanted to say. But then we could talk about more specific examples. So there's pitches that you're, you know, maybe sending to a venue or to a record label or, you know, anyone you want to have a working relationship with, and they don't write you back, or they write you back and say no. There's also bad press. You know, you submit to get a show previewed or maybe an album reviewed or something, and they don't like it. There's unwanted comments that happen during or after a show. It could be heckling or booing, but it could also just be the person that, like, unfortunately this happens to women, I think, more than men, but like the 7-year-old drunk guy comes up to the 25-year-old female guitarist singer and suddenly starts critiquing their pedals and telling them how they could play better solos or something. Like, they're trying to be helpful, but really it's super condescending. So There's, did you have a comment?
No, I was remembering that text message you sent me.
Well, that
I didn't know if you wanted to share that on the podcast. Or
yeah,
not,
well, so that that kind of is part of the next thing I was going to say, which is sort of snippy or rude or condescending emails you might get it just out of the blue, or maybe in response. Maybe they're on your mailing list, which was in my case. Someone wrote me back after I shared my latest song, and they wanted to tell me that my vocals weren't loud enough in the mix and that I needed to be more confident. And that also, in order for me to tell a better story with my lyrics, I should listen to the Eagles and Foreigner, Bob Dylan, REO Speedwagon, like all these people who made music like 800 years ago. And which I like all of them. But I was more like, wait, that's the reference point for these recommendations. Like, I'm making music now. Like, anyways, I don't know what more there is to say about that. It kind of just made me scratch my head, and I sent it to Kevin because I was like, this person's on my mailing list. I don't know why or how, if the music I make doesn't resonate with them. But anyways, I'll leave it at that.
Oh, go ahead. Keep going.
Oh, I was just going to say a couple other kinds of rejection is the doubt from your family or friends or coworkers that you're any good. I mean, that sometimes I think that's most damaging of all, especially if it happens like earlier in your life when really you're not good. Like, who's good when they're 14? No one. But you have to keep trying something you're passionate at in order to get good. So that doubt can be a kind of crushing rejection. Let's see. Oh, one big failure is just sort of like your own dashed expectations. Like, you get to a point in your life and you thought, oh, I thought I would have had more fans by now, or I would have had more playlist placements, or I don't know, any measure or metric you can, you know, set your sights on and not achieve. Those things kind of, you know, eat away at us as well. And then there's like this weird thing that can happen where you kind of get ghosted by other bands in your community or by venues. Maybe you played a venue like 3 or 4 times and you thought it was going well, and then suddenly they kind of stop writing you back, or they stop responding to your emails. So then you're like, wait, what happened? Did I offend someone? Now I don't look cool? And so there's that. What else is there? Oh, and then lastly, I think most important of all, is the little voice in your own head that says, this isn't good enough. And that's the kind of rejection I think you should definitely listen to when it's your own, you know, creative intuition saying that you could do something better.
As long as you don't get in your head and you know, we, most people in general, but especially artists, suffer from imposter syndrome and all that kind of stuff where you think, When is everybody going to figure out I don't know what I'm doing? Just waiting for that shoe to drop when everyone goes, oh, yeah, he doesn't know what he's doing. Now I see it.
So then you need a sidekick or a sounding board or something to make sure that voice doesn't get too loud.
Well, and that's where I think you mentioned family and friends. And we were talking on a live stream on the CD Baby Facebook page yesterday, and we were sort of previewing this episode of the podcast, and someone mentioned that, you know, they wrote a lullaby for their kids and their kids didn't like it, and that was sort of brutal rejection
because it's so sweet. That's the sweetest thing you could ever do, and then your kids be like, eh, whatever, you suck, dad.
Well, and having a teenage daughter and a 10-year-old daughter, I can tell you that I've tried my darndest to get them to understand the cool factor, having a dad playing guitar and being a rock band, and it just falls on deaf ears. So there's nothing you can do. You're just dad. That's the thing. That's the hard thing. Like, it was funny. I took my daughter to the NAMM show with me last year, and she saw me speak to artists and everything, and she's like, oh my gosh. And all these people lined up to talk to me, and she's like, dad's famous. And it's really hard for the people around you to see you for anything other than, you know, your immediate relationship, especially family. And so I bring all that to say that feedback you get from them is usually or oftentimes can be very suspect, in the sense that sometimes your mom is just loving everything you do and they refuse to say that anything you do could use improvement. Sometimes other people around you just know you for, that's just Kevin. He's my neighbor. Yeah, I guess he's in a band, you know.
Yeah, there's cool, no way nice that guy music. Could be good because he lives next to me.
Yeah, it's just, there's so many things with close relationships where they just see you as something different. So it's hard to get feedback. Or when you do get feedback, sometimes that stuff can sting the most because you're like, these people know me. Why aren't they champions? It's like, because they don't know you as this musician over here. They know you in a different way, and it's hard for them to see past that.
Well, I know we have a lot more to talk through, but I thought of a few other kinds of rejection, and I'm sure listeners will have a lot to add too, but like even something like posting a picture on Instagram and people don't, you know, like three people like it, or like you put a new video on Facebook and, you know, you expected thousands to watch it and instead you get like 20 likes or something. Like, depending on what our expectations are, even that can feel like rejection and failure. I mean, certainly if you're putting money behind like an ad and it doesn't perform well, or you're putting money into a release and you don't sell enough copies to kind of earn back your investment, all those things could be felt as failure.
I kind of look at it as you got to put it in buckets. There's the bucket of like the one you mentioned that to me is one of the most frustrating ones, is a venue, getting rejection from a venue. Because it's like, most cities don't have a lot of venues. And even if you are in a big city with many venues, there's usually a handful that cater to each genre. And then when you actually whittle it down to the ones that are actually worth playing, there's probably one or two. And then when you start getting a little wider, it's like, yeah, I can go play there, but their sound system's a mess. It's, you know, we can play, but it's not going to be that great of an experience for anybody. So you're really dealing with usually in a city, like one or two venues that you're really trying to target. And if they keep rejecting you, that gets frustrating because there's not much you can do about it. I think there's some strategies you can try. Maybe you need better promo materials. Maybe your emails have been really abrupt or rude sounding, or maybe you need to go meet them in person and buy them coffee. And there's a way to get in the door there. But that one's pretty frustrating to me because there's not a lot you can do to remedy it.
Well, that makes me think of another thing we should talk about, is that interpreting what a rejection even means, because a venue could be saying no to you and it has nothing to do with how much they like your music. It could have nothing to do with how good your music is. It could simply be that you're a new band and on a Thursday night, they need a band they know can bring in 300 people or whatever. It could purely be about the size of your audience or how many people drink booze when they come to your shows. Like, they've got a bar they need to make money at. So even a no isn't a, I hate you. It's just, no, this doesn't work for me for whatever reason. And the same could be true of, someone who's writing for Rolling Stone and they cover, you know, they've got such limited space for unsigned, you know, indie kind of music, that the person who bumps in line ahead of you and gets the coverage, it's only because they have some other thing, some other attention they've got or whatever. And again, it could have nothing to do with the music. It could be simply that something else caught the person's attention. So it's worth remembering that not every no is equal to I hate you, you suck, go home, quit.
That's how I interpret it.
Well, I think that's how we all interpret it until we recalibrate.
Yeah, well, and that's what I'm talking about, like there being buckets. There's that professional side bucket, like I didn't get the press I wanted, I didn't get the gig, I'm trying to build a relationship there, and the rejection is could be based on my music, but it could be based on a whole bunch of other factors. Then there's, you know, the rejection of like family and friends or lack of support maybe, and that it's like more feeling confident in what you're doing that is good. And I think, and even sometimes from fans or music communities. And I think that with that bucket of it, it's like at some point you got to have the confidence to know that the music you're making is good. And even if you're the only one that likes it, you know, there's a lot of artists that made landmark albums that at first got mediocre responses from people. But if you feel passionate about it, you know it's good, you know, sometimes those voices, you just got to push them aside because I know this is good. And someday somebody might recognize it. Maybe they won't, you know. That's, you know, I love that story of Wilco and their album that became the album of the year. And all these people told them it sucked and they weren't even going to release it.
Yeah, right. They lost their label deal and had to buy the record back because they had so little support for it.
Yeah. And then it becomes this album of the year. So it happens to everybody. I think it's important to understand where it's coming from and that failure, you had a point here that failure isn't the opposite of success. It's the foundation that a lot of times some of this is good feedback. Like, here's what we need, you know, and you're not doing that right now. So we can't accept you. And mm-hmm. you can use that information to either improve your strategy or your approach, or maybe it is something to consider when you're writing and recording. Maybe it's not.
Yeah. I mean, this is another story I've probably told 10 times on this podcast, but the bad review that had the most, that hurt the most in my entire life. It hurt that much because deep down I knew it was true. And when I got honest with myself about that, I changed my music accordingly, and it led to what I consider all the good creative things in my life. And so in that case, that bad review was like such a blessing. Though it didn't feel that way for, you know, months or maybe even years. But in hindsight, it was the best thing that could have ever happened to me.
I'll say, like, with this album that we're working on right now, we got to a point where it felt like there are the fans that loved us from our label days. And, you know, that's great. We want to bring those people along. And all the press we keep getting with our more recent releases always refer back to those and like comparing it to those. And I just got to the point where it's like, we love that foundation and we love those fans and we love that our catalog, but at some point we just got to leave that behind. And with this new album, we're just like, we're just going to do something new and different and push towards growth. Because if we keep thinking about, oh, let's try and, you know, relive the hits, and so those people will be happy about us and write us like and see us as new again, it's like they're never going to, because they've decided that we're that band. And so we got to just forge a new direction. And I think sometimes that feedback, because all the press kind of felt like slightly it felt positive, but then slightly negative, like, well, they'll never be as good as those hits. I'm like, that person's never going to see beyond that. So let's just stop playing in that world altogether and do something new and different. Yeah. And not be afraid to try new things, because if we're already getting sort of mediocre responses, then because it's never going to give them the same feeling they had when they heard our music when they were 18 back in the 90s, then maybe they're not our fans. We need to move beyond and dive deeper into our creativity and do some new things and not worry about the fact that it doesn't sound like the music from the past.
Yeah. I mean, that kind of to a point I wanted to make later on, but I'll just jump to it, is it's okay to stop seeking more approval at some point. Like, if you've got enough of a press foundation, you've got quotes you can use, you've got, you know, some audience that's, you know, who knows how big an audience you need to sort of sustain your music making. But like, it's okay at some point to just not court any more press. Like, there's other ways to reach fan bases. You know, you can use advertising. You can, if you've got what you need already, feel free to just step off the treadmill and go about making your music and communicating directly to your audience.
Yeah. Cause sometimes if you've got something good going, the press will come to you. And in that way, that, you know, that it's going to be most likely a very positive experience, where if you're constantly pitching to people and you finally get their attention and they're like, oh, okay. And sometimes if they're writing out of needing something to write about, or because they feel like they're doing you a favor, that's not going to be necessarily what you wanted anyway.
Yeah, totally. I've a few more comments about getting feedback and negative feedback is that anyone who's used SubmitHub or a service like Playlist Push, you might know this feeling of getting contradictory feedback. First of all, I got a lot of that recently on my new single. And, you know, one person would say, you know, cool song, but it's a little bit boring. It doesn't do anything daring. And then literally the next person will be like, I love this. The lyrics are really cool, but it seems a little too experimental and like whatever. So like opposite things. One person is like, your voice sounds kind of boring and whatever. The melody doesn't do anything. And the next person will be like, I love your voice. What a catchy melody. So no one agrees. I don't know what you do with that. But then there's the other kind of common rejection, which, or I don't know how common it is. I actually, this is maybe a humble brag. I got it quite a bit, which is like, really cool. Love this. It's not right for my blog. Or like, everything about this song is amazing, but unfortunately it's not going to fit on my playlist.
Yeah. I find that more on Submit Hub than Playlist Push, but yes, you will find things that it feels like I got my music to the right person. I targeted the right people. I didn't send it to people that said they weren't interested in what I do. They should love it. And then they say, sounds great. Not right for me. And it's like, but you write about pop rock or very specific, you know, genres, and I'm right. That, and you're saying it's not right for your blog. I'm so confused. What's going on here?
Yeah. And I didn't do the most like thorough research on who I was submitting to. Like SubmitHub has pretty good filters for genre appropriateness and, you know, their, what do they call it? Sort of rejection to acceptance percentages and all that stuff. But I admit to, I didn't go to all these blogs and like really investigate. I was kind of just doing the quick way. So maybe there would have been better blogs for me to submit to that were closer fits, but I didn't get that sense. I thought maybe it's just, maybe that week they were feeling like depressing. So actually someone accused my song of being way too upbeat. And that is something no one has ever said to me before.
Chris, I was just way too happy after listening to your music.
Normally people are like, yeah, it's like really, really sad. You're the voice of doom. One other thing to talk about with Submit Hub is that honestly, none of them really stung that much. Like, you know, I have the disappointment of being rejected, but I was fine with it all. Like, a split second of being bummed and then move on. Like I was really fine, which I think means I've arrived at a certain level of comfort with my own music making. But then that one email I got from my email list, which was unsolicited from someone, you know, who presumably responded to some music I've made before. I don't know why they're on my list if not, but that one, which I didn't ask for and which actually wasn't all that critical, in the grand scheme of things, kind of really got under my skin and hurt in a way that all of the way more thorough focused rejections didn't. And the only thing I can think of is that one was solicited and one wasn't. And like with Submit Hub, I knew what I was getting into. I was paying to have my music, you know, on the chopping block or whatever you'd call it. Like, so I don't know if people experience that as well. Like one kind of punishment you're signing up for, the other just kind of comes as like a surprise blow. And then you're like, ah, someone just hit me. What?
Well, that's what I was saying earlier. I think that some of the worst rejection or feedback is when it feels like you're being blindsided. Like you didn't ask for that. That person went out of their way to write you that email, or that person went out of their way to get on the internet and tell you that you suck. And so it's weird when people do that. That's, you know, I think that's a behavior that has emerged more with the internet because people can do it in anonymity sometimes, or it's very passive aggressive and they're not in front of the person. People say things that they would never say to the person if they were in the same room together. So I think some of that is something to consider. And, you know, oftentimes like someone sent me an email about the podcast recently and didn't like an episode, strongly disliked it. And I responded and they backed way down when they realized, oh, he's actually going to talk to me.
Well, and then another thing, speaking of just internet usage, is that tone can get lost. And the person who wrote me, I mean, for all I know, they could be a listener of the podcast and then they can correct me in this, but like, they wrote things in a somewhat neutral way that I took to be unsolicited criticisms. But for all I know, they really could have been like, no, I dig that song. I was just trying to like relate to you in some way. So I had some feedback, you know, like they might not have even intended it to be barbed at all. Maybe they really just thought it was helpful advice for someone that they, whose music they've admired. And I don't know, to me, it just showed up like, I didn't ask for this. And it sounds like from what you've written that you really hated my song.
Why hasn't email come up with a tone indicator?
Like tone, yeah.
I'm trying to be a dick right now, so read it like.
What? Well, yeah, Google can take Portuguese and instantly turn it into English. I don't even have to tell it it's Portuguese. It just knows. But they haven't done the same thing for emotions yet.
They need to. So then I can go, this is some helpful feedback for you. Oh, okay. They're trying to be helpful. They're just awkward. Any final points before we get into some calls and emails?
A few. I guess we've already touched on a lot of this as we went through the different kinds of rejection and failure and bad press you can get. We sort of talked about some ways to deal with it. But I think trusting your intuition about what it really means is good up to a point. And then maybe you need some teammates to encourage you if you start to get too negative. Also, don't combat the bad press. If someone writes something bad about you or a venue says no thanks, like do not get all defensive and hit them back. Like that just shows great insecurity. It's not going to do you any favors. You'll burn bridges. Suddenly, just instead of that one venue not booking you anymore, like pretty soon every venue in town is going to know about it. So yeah, try not to get defensive. There are ways, and I think we've talked about them in the past, of turning that kind of hurt into a community rallying cry. And, you know, you could share a bad review with your fans and you could kind of poke fun at it like it doesn't hurt. Or you could be like, this stung. Like, what do you guys think? And, you know, if your fans really love you, they'll stick up for you. So there's ways to do that. But, the last thing is don't be afraid to stop seeking approval. And if you've got some good press quotes, if you've got some good bragging rights, just you can use those. You don't need to keep subjecting yourself to punishment.
Well, and I like the last point you had here. You said ultimately it should be about your own creative satisfaction and maybe the opinion of your fans. But to me, that's sort of where I've gotten to that point where, yes, I want our music to be successful. Yes, I want people to stream it and play it and us get asked to play shows to more than 20 people. But ultimately, the creation process and making the music, if it's not something that I'm satisfied with, then it feels like something's wrong. That should be the start. You should be satisfied with what you're doing. And in the act of creating and making a thing should provide enough satisfaction just in that in of itself.
Yeah. And I was laughing because was it in the last episode we were talking about how you should really always try to have that feeling of like, oh, this new one is our best thing. Because if you don't, like, what's it going to be like if you go to your fans and you're like, I think this is our fifth best record. Like, yeah. It should always feel like the most exciting, best, most mature thing you can do.
Yes. All right. Well, if you have any thoughts or comments you want to weigh in on or tell us about some failures or rejection you've had, you can call our listener line at 360-524-2209 or email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com and tell us how you maybe about some rejection that you turned into a victory or how you used it to get better results or I don't know. Maybe
how it just demoralized you so much that you quit making music, but for some reason you still listen to this podcast.
That could be true. All right. Well, let's move on because we do have some calls and emails to get to, and we've got some good ones. We put out a call for 2020 plans, you know, years we're heading into the fall. What's your plans for fall 2020? And we got a couple responses for that and a few other things. So let's dive right in. Here's the first call.
Hi, Kevin and Chris. You asked for our fall 2020 plans, so I figured I'd call in. I manage an artist named Dante Mazzetti, and during the pandemic, we really leaned into Dante being an online musician. So there's four things that were huge game changers for us this year. And they're all very interconnected. The first is live streaming. And I know you guys are completely over musicians live streaming, but it's really working incredibly well for Dante. He's live streaming exclusively on Facebook right now. He's built and continues to build this really incredible community of fans from all over the world, and they're buying his stuff. They're continually asking him when his next album's coming out. They're telling his friend, their friends about him. It's great. But what we're doing is then we are using Facebook ads to retarget anybody who's interacted with his live streams and offer them free songs to get on his email list. And that's been just great. Our acquisition costs are really low by doing it that way. So we're going to keep doing that. And another thing that we did while the pandemic was upon us was move his email list over to Drip, which is a CRM like MailChimp, but it plays nicer with Shopify. Drip's amazing, by the way. If anybody's shopping for a CRM, they're just phenomenal. And then the last big change was that we built a Shopify store with a mix of pre-made merch, like CDs and t-shirts that we would normally sell at shows, and then print-on-demand merch, which you guys have talked about in the past. And we actually just went with Chris's recommendation, the same guy that, or the same company that he goes with. And that's been really good on expanding the merch line and giving people more options. So moving forward in the fall, we're going to be doing all that stuff. And then I'm going to be contacting you guys soon because we're going to bundle up two EPs and a single that he released in 2019 and put that into a full-length album, release that. And then, as recommended by you guys, we're going to start releasing singles every 6 weeks. And we're really excited about that and get our get all that going. We already have the first one ready to go. Also, I wanted to quickly comment on a couple other things from the episode. Chris, I totally feel you about SubmitHub. It's an amazing tool, but it can be completely soul-crushing for artists. If at all possible, I would really recommend that an artist get someone else to run their SubmitHub submissions, if that's possible. There's also a really great article by Hi54 blog. It's hi54.blog. It's called SubmitHub, Not a Scam. I found it a really important piece to read to understand the perspective from the blogger side. And if you Google.
The call got cut off because she hit the 3 minute mark, but there was lots of good stuff in there and we didn't get her name. She didn't say her name at the beginning. So I don't, she said the artist.
Oh,
name.
Just the musician she was working with. Right. Yeah. I was going to say, normally when people go that long, it's like, it feels like, come on, get to the point. And I was sorry that call ended. I was like, no, oh, there's so much good stuff in there.
Yeah. Lots of good things. And for clarity, Chris and I are not over the idea of live streaming. We were just highlighting how a lot of artists jumped into it haphazardly because they thought that's what we do now. And really making sure people understand the relationship with their audience and that it's moving them in the right direction and not just filling up their time with something else.
Yeah, well, so, I mean, you and I probably make a lot of pronouncements on this podcast.
And are you about to make one? My inbox is going to get full of feedback.
No, like we've been doing this podcast for a long time. So we've probably made many, many pronouncements that we would go back on, that we would now feel hypocritical about, that were wrong, that like, so ultimately the caveat is always like, if it's working for you, if it's working for your fans, like keep doing it no matter what we say. There's really no right or wrong. It's like, just what works. So yes, live streaming is still clearly working. I also think that they're using live streaming in a way where it's not just a one-off, or sorry, one-off is not the right term. It's not just kind of this extra activity you're doing all the time. It sounds like it's built into an infrastructure that's thought out, and they have a way to, you know, quickly, maybe automatically, retarget the people who are engaging with the live streams to get merch in front of them or to get them on their email list. It sounds like once they're on the email list, maybe they have some automations going between Drip and Shopify. So it's like, it sounds way more planned out so that those live streams are, you know, not the beginning and the end of the engagement. It's a way to get people into their ecosystem or, you know, to nurture them in some way. So I think that's brilliant.
Yeah, I'd love to hear more about those Facebook ads, because speaking of podcast making a proclamation. There was another podcast that I will remain nameless that declared that offering a free download for an email sign up on Facebook was a waste of time. And clearly this is working for them. So I'm curious on what those ads say. And if it is working, then...
Wait, you're saying that another podcast said that you should not offer a download for an email?
Yes.
And yet some artist is doing it and having great results? Is that...
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. They weren't talking about this. They weren't talking about this artist, but obviously, but they were saying that nobody wants to download anymore. So offer them something different. And so I hadn't heard of anyone doing that specifically recently where I've heard that, oh yes, we're doing that and we're getting great results where here we're hearing that. And so I've not tried that yet. Maybe because that's
another pronouncement I would make. No one wants your damn download. Stop doing that. But see, I'm wrong. What do I know?
It depends on your fan base too. You know,
yeah.
They didn't, in the call, she didn't say what kind of music they do. There's certain genres where they like certain things still. Like if you're a country artist, you're probably having more success selling CDs or folk artist than if you are a hip hop artist. You know, that would be my assumption.
Totally.
All right. Well, we got more to go on to. Let's go on to the next call.
Aloha, guys. This is Tori calling. Again, love the podcast. I just have two quick questions. The first question is, how can we as independent artists who have music on streaming sites like iTunes and Google Play, etc., have our information pulled up when you look us up? So, for instance, when you pull up Prince, it's going to have Prince, the former artist. It's going to talk about him and his music with a picture, and, you know, the website or that page may even look different. So how can we as artists edit our page, put something on there, make it look different, more pleasing to the eye, and those kind of things? Is that possible, or is that something that costs a bazillion dollars that only big name artists can do? And then the last question is, as an independent artist, there's so many things you got to do with Facebook and YouTube and Spotify. And you guys, I am a CD Baby pro member, but there's also, you know, Twitter and Snapchat and all these different things. How important are those things to an independent artist? The climate of today, there's so much bullying and craziness going on. And I just don't want to really spend that much more time on a computer or on, you know, Instagram or whatever. I don't have Instagram. I don't have Snapchat. I don't have a Twitter account. But how important is it for me as an independent artist to have one of those? Anyway, those are my quick questions. Sorry it took so long to get those out. You guys are awesome. Aloha.
Thanks for the call, Tori. And because he said aloha twice, I'm assuming he's in Hawaii. Which would
seems
be nice.
Like a safe assumption.
First off, the first question he asked about Apple Music. If you go into your CD Baby account and under the Tools and Promotion tab, there is a link to connect to Apple Music for Artists. And excuse me, once you do that, you can update your picture or add a picture to your artist profile in Apple Music. And there may be some other things you can add, but someone like Prince probably has a special feature that they've created for artists at that level. So there are some options for independent artists, but you know, when you get a landmark artist like Prince, or, you know, it was Michael Jackson's birthday recently, a lot of people were exchanging Michael Jackson links. I'm sure he has a gigantic profile on some of these platforms that's different. Spotify doesn't seem to do that as much. They all seem to be very consistent.
I was wondering if maybe what he's talking about is when he goes and he sees the artist's profile on Apple Music or iTunes, he might be seeing the bio that's delivered by All Music. And then if so, because I'm looking at my profile on Apple Music and I still have a bio there that was delivered in 2008 by AllMusic. So obviously I need to do something to update that. But
I've tried and tried and failed many times.
Yeah, okay. But anyways, you might want to investigate AllMusic because that is clearly still being fed to Apple.
Yeah, and Apple over the years has done several different things. Like they tried to do, I forget what it was, where it was iTunes Plus or something. I forget. It was where there was almost like web content built into iTunes. And so some of that still may be legacy stuff that existed as well. I'm not sure if they got rid of all of that. But yeah, make sure you're connected to Apple Music for Artists and you can update a photo there. And more options will come over time.
Man, what did you? What are your thoughts on his "Do I need to be everywhere on social media?" question?
No, I mean, if you're not going to engage there, then you don't have to be anywhere. But I would say that it's good to be present on at least one social network because fans will seek you out on social. And if you're just not everywhere, I mean, if you're just impossible to find or you're not on one of the main outlets, people might think that you just don't exist or it's a misconnection point. I just got my hands on a survey that somebody did surveying artists. And I think they were supposed to be independent artists that took this survey. And it was a survey that was conducted in points all around the globe. But the social network that artists said was the most useful for music promotion was Instagram. And I think, I forget what number two was, but that would be the one that I would start with as well. I just think Instagram has so many different ways to connect and people can engage both with stories and the main feed and their strategies to both. And I feel like it's streamlined enough, but has enough features and options that it's really, to me, the most useful social network. The only thing that it's missing is easier shareability. But there are ways people can share your post into their feed. And that's, I'm seeing that activity happening more and more lately. But yeah, so I would recommend at least being one place so fans know that they can find you. Other people might say you should be everywhere. I mean, I would definitely, if you're an artist, I would claim an account on all those platforms because you would hate to start having success and then find out that someone took your Twitter name or whatever social network, you know?
Yeah. I mean, and then to give you a non-answer, I also think, you know, it depends on genre, depends on the age of your audience, depends on your own interests. Like if you're terrible at taking photos and you have no design skills, maybe Instagram's not for you. But like, so it's a really, it's a hard one to give a specific recommendation on.
We got one more call. Let's jump into that call and then we'll hit the emails. This is another one about fall plans for 2020.
Hey, Kevin and Chris, this is Ryan from the band Quitting Whitney. Kevin, we've kind of corresponded a little bit before, and I believe you follow us on Instagram, so appreciate that. I'm calling in response to the kind of state of affairs question for bands right now in all this. Wanted to give you an update for folks who don't know us. I was commiserating with Kevin not long ago because we left for our tour on March 11th of this year, and that is kind of widely recognized as one of the days where this pandemic really kind of started to tighten its grip on all of the United States and the world. And so as all of our shows were canceled in a dark wave of cancellations, we came back and licked our wounds and got back into writing, as I'm sure a lot of bands did. But then, you know, after about a couple of weeks into April and into May, we realized we had written about 10 songs and are now in the final stages of editing most of them, and two of which are ready to go live. And it got me thinking about how you know, what we did was basically dedicate a month where we all lost our jobs, but we just dedicated a month, and actually turned out to just be a couple of weeks, 2 weeks really. And we called it Content Creation Week, where we had my sister who likes to do video follow us around everywhere where we kind of went, and we were in the studio getting, footage of us. And then we kind of shot a DIY that spiraled into doing a DIY music video, which we're launching soon, and it looks fantastic. All this to say is in 2 weeks, we put together essentially an album's worth of content, both audibly and visually. And now, in reaction to what Spotify has been saying, as far as dripping out music constantly, in those 2 weeks, we have created what is now turned into a year's worth of content to push out. It wasn't extremely difficult or expensive, and now we're sitting on close to 25 to 30 finished products of just various forms of content, be it like a little video, an actual full song, acoustic version of that song, piano version, whatever it is. All this to say, like, in just a short amount of time, artists out there can kind of double down and create, put it all together, and then plan it out. It's possible, and we're looking forward to drip methoding this out over the next couple of months. Hopefully it does help us, but if not, we're happy to be just making art.
All right. Thanks, Ryan, from Quitting Whitney. And I think that was the end of his message, but he also hit the 3-minute mark at the voicemail as well.
That's awesome. I mean, I know you talk a lot about how you try to do that when you're on tour with your band, because you guys are together so infrequently that, like, you got to get the pictures and the videos and the live, you know, the acoustic things you guys do. It's like kind of a mad dash, but it seemed like he did that for in a similar way, but maybe from the comforts of his home.
Yeah, I think that's a smart move right now. I like the idea of, like, we're going to even call it Content Creation Week and just focus on making stuff, and the goal to be, have a bunch of stuff made, ready to go in the bag, so we can start putting it out over the next year when touring may happen again. But if not, we're prepared with stuff to launch and release and keep the engagement going. I think it's so much easier when you just focus in like that and say, I'm going to cut all the distractions out and just focus on creating stuff right now. And then once I'm done, I can build a strategy around it. I like that a lot, because I think so many times we're trying to do them at the same time, like creating and putting it out, and, like, you know, some of the social media stuff or the videos and things, and feeling like, well, I'm in the studio now, so I got to put the photos up now. And it's like, no, you don't have to do that. Nobody knows. Get it all done. Focus on just the capturing, the creating process and all that kind of thing. Then make your, you know, refine that, build a strategy, and then you can drip it out over time and no one will know the difference, because it happened when they see it online. That's when it happened.
Right.
All right. And I was following those guys. For whatever reason, we connected that very week, and I followed them on Instagram, and they were out on the road when everything got canceled and had to make their way back home, and tried to make the best of it. And then it basically just had to pack it all in. And all right, we got a couple emails. Let's get through those and then we'll wrap this up. Hi, Kevin. I hope this finds you well. How's the Small Town Poets post-production coming along? Recording sessions look like fun in an idyllic spot. I remember you and Chris chatting a while back about albums versus singles on the podcast. I've wondered about whether there's a resurgence of albums in 2020. Bandcamp seems to be doing well, and there's been a whole lot more innovation in songwriting with lockdown and restrictions. As my own album approaches its release date on September 1st, I hope it went well, I've been thinking about a way of engaging people into the ideas of the lyrics and joining a discussion. I always remembered reading the lyrics in the CD or cassette of an album I bought when I was a child. And I remember that while I had favorite songs on the albums, perhaps even just one song, I still came away from the whole album feeling like I had a better understanding of the artist and what they were about, because I'd engaged in a wider catalog of songs. It also meant that other fans and I could engage longer, wider, deeper because I had listened to the whole album and there was more to chew on. And he says, I wonder whether it's worth another podcast episode. And kind regards, Ryan Calder. Hope the album release went well, Ryan. He gave me a link to a promo video he made, and it was a cool promo, and the music sounded great. What do you think, Chris? I thought this was an interesting email because it was like the same day or the day before I was looking at the numbers at CD Baby and the number of submissions we get and noticed that album submissions were trending much higher than they had been year over year for the last, 2018, 2019, regular album submissions were sort of flat where all the activity seemed to be in singles, where those were just exploding like up crazy. But albums are on the rise as well, and it's not because singles are still exploding like crazy. So when he emailed me that, I was already thinking, are people sort of getting back into, I'm going to make a whole album?
Okay, so I don't know the exact answer, but here's my thoughts. We went through a decade of hearing about the end of the album and how it's, the singles on playlists era, which is all true, but a few things might have happened. People are now thinking about singles more strategically, but not at the exclusion of the album experience. So maybe they're doing both, whereas for a while people maybe were abandoning the album in favor of singles. Then also, if the spike is in the last 6 months that you're seeing, could it be that just people are home with more time to bundle up the music they'd been making or to just make more music, and they don't want to have to just put it out as an endless string of singles, so they're putting out more albums that way?
Yeah. Well, even in the album era of, the 60s through the 90s, I'll say, or the early 2000s, it was still a singles game with singles on radio. So I think when everything went digital and accessing the market became easier, and there was some time where some labels were just like, they would just get one song from an artist, break that song, and the artist was never really heard of again. But I think that's kind of settled down some, where like what Ryan's saying, you got to have more to chew on. And also, I think the idea of a single in streaming world, if you're thinking like a single on radio, you're thinking about it all wrong. Because it's not about just your 3-minute pop hit, which is what radio was all about. It's about understanding where the groupings of songs are that your individual tracks can fit in. And if you have more tracks, you have more opportunity. So it's not just about a pop hit. It's about, hey, there's this acoustic mellow song that's real chill. Hey, that chill playlist over there may like that song. It would never be played on pop radio or rock radio or any sort of radio station because it's not that kind of song. So I think there's things like that where people are thinking it's not just about a single like the pop world had thought about singles. It's about getting music to audiences that want to hear it. And there's different groupings of music out there. And it has nothing to do with whether you released one or 10. It's just whether the song can find its audience that way. So I'd love to hear what artists are thinking about that. If they're like, I was releasing singles, but now I'm going to do some more albums. I've always said that the album shouldn't go away because like what he said is it gives it's a bigger musical movement and it provides context for your songs and maybe your musical growth or what you're trying to do. It makes it easier for people to digest it, especially if you're changing your sound over time. All right, we've got one more email. Dear Kevin and Chris, thank you both so much for all the help, honesty, and life hacks you've provided on the show. I've been a listener for a year and I love it so much. Thank you. I am an electro indie pop artist who records and performs under my real name, Emily Afton. I've been doing this full-time music hustle for about 7 years now, and lately I just feel so ready to get my project to the next level, whatever that even means. Throughout this journey, I've gotten to crowdfund and release a full-length album, gotten to tour the US, signed a small indie label with whom I just released my new EP. And yet I'm still very far away from where I want to be, which is paying my bills entirely through music and setting myself up for a sustainable, lifelong career. I'm wondering if, A, you think my stage name being so normy, she says, is getting in the way of my project success, especially since my music is in the electronic indie pop genre. Or is that super naive, reductive thinking? And if so, do you have any advice on where to put your energy when you feel like you're hitting a wall in your career? And the last thing I will add is I'm thinking of changing my project's name to Afton, which is my middle name. Do you have any advice or resources for name changing? How to make sure the name is all cleared and avoid legal battles? My apologies that this question is so vast, but I appreciate any and all that you can say about the topic. You're all the best. Thanks again, Emily Afton. I listened to Emily's music. She had a link in the email and I listened to it. I thought it fit. Her name was fine. I thought it worked well.
And just so I understand, right now she's going under Emily Afton as the artist name, right? And she was considering moving it just to Afton.
I believe that's what she's saying, yes.
Okay.
I liked Emily Afton because it's clearly her, like both her album covers have her on it. I think that highlights that, you know, she is the artist. It's not just an image of, you know, when I see Afton, that could be anything, you know, that could be a band, that could be whatever. The music sounded great. It's like she said, it's like indie pop. It's got an electronic vibe, but there's real instruments in there. There's real electric guitar and thought it sounded great. I never would have said, Emily Afton, this doesn't match. I would keep it. Here's the thing. You've already got two things out. And if we've touched on it numerous times on the podcast, especially with listener feedback, we get a lot of artists wanting to change their name. And it is, in my opinion, not wise unless there's a real strong reason to do so. First of all, you already mentioned you have Emily Afton Music on all the platforms. That's great. Afton, you're probably not going to get that. I haven't even looked, but I can assume that there's something called that, whatever it is, that's taking at Afton. If not, that would be surprising to me. But I think, you know, you've already established this thing. Why deconstruct it? I can't imagine anyone saying they didn't like you because your name was Emily Afton and not Afton.
Problem solved. Look at this.
Problem solved. Changing lives. All right. Well, if you've got a question or comment, or you want to give us your fall 2020 plans, or just what you've been doing in general, or how you've been dealing with failure and rejection, you can call our listener line at 360-524-2209 or email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com. And don't forget the voicemail box. It's a Google Voice box. It only allows you to go 3 minutes. So try to get it all in. Or if you know you got cut off, you can call back and just pick up where you left off and then we can push them together. But, you know, try to just get it out in 3 minutes. But those calls today were great and I could have taken more. All right. Well, anything else before we say goodbye, Chris?
No, I'm finishing, you know, one of the four albums I have in the works. So that's exciting. I'm starting to think about press, despite the conversation we just had about not needing it. But, you know, the whole thing of putting out a record, I'm really at the exciting part of the music almost being completely mixed and done and sort of how to get people to care, how to tell the story. So I'm looking forward to successes and failures in that department.
That's exciting. Yeah, we have been all the other guys are at that farmhouse that's been turned into a recording studio, tracking vocals this week and finishing up keyboards. And I've got one track I need to record here at home. But this has been the most efficient writing and recording process for us, I think, almost ever.
You just needed a global pandemic.
So that's been exciting. And I feel like we've hit a new groove in that way, and just being able to move faster. Quality isn't suffering, but just, you know, not letting things get in the way of just finishing things up and getting recording done and giving ourselves shorter timelines, because, you know, I think that's part of the problem with, you know, how people can record at home and it's easy to, you know, track stuff. I'll do that tomorrow. I'll get around to that this weekend. 3 weekends go by. Oh, we'll finish that up then. And so this one, we've just been boom, boom, boom. We're done. So I'm excited. I'm excited to hear stuff. I haven't heard some of it with bass and all that yet. So it should be cool.
Sweet. Can't wait to hear it.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for this edition of the podcast. And we'll catch you guys next time.
See ya.
You've been listening to the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.